All the street lights surround me in the wall-to-wall prison of my city. Flickering dirty neon over alleys mean and dirty streets, while my neighborhood is torn down around me.
Hello, everybody, from that nightclub at the end of the world. It is Sunday, the 16th of March in the year 2014. As all of us, I'm sure, are aware to one degree or another, this week marks the third anniversary of the earthquake and tsunami which devastated the nuclear reactors and all of Fukushima Prefecture in Japan. We have a good guest tonight to talk about that. Before I bring Libby Halevi on, I want to make just a few observations here about the state of the world as a whole, and I think that'll set a background for the conversation we're going to have tonight. On this property where I'm staying, I have landed in Calistoga, California. It's been beautiful weather, 76, 77 degrees today, bright sunshine, green everywhere, and I'm not feeling guilty about it. I had a great conversation with a guy who, on the property, Brad Gates, who is known as the Tomato King of Northern California. He's got like 20,000 starts going into a greenhouse that I can walk to from the trailer I'm staying in. And he made a point. He said for the first days after transplanting, tomato plants or all plants are just in shock. They're just trying to hang on. Then you start to see them respond to the sun as they sink roots. Well, I took that to heart because I've been in a state of shock pretty much since I... during the whirlwind move out of Colorado to here, and I moved with the big steps this week to start sinking roots, and it's paying off. It's showing benefits. That's all going as well as could be expected. The other thing that I will offer is my observation this week. I came back here to teach, and now I'm getting a clear understanding of what it is I want to teach. What has become clear to me is that around the world there are hundreds of millions of people, perhaps a billion, who totally understand that the multiplicity of crises impacting the human race now is solely a spiritual issue, and we want our own space. Not that we have to convince anyone else of what we believe, but we are entitled by sheer strength of numbers to have a space where we can approach these issues together, and that's the direction I'm going to be moving in. All right, updating on the world. Let's be very, very clear about this. This summer is going to break more temperature records than have ever been broken in a year, mark my words. The horrendous winter that has tormented the Midwest and the Eastern Seaboard is only now just loosening its grip. At the same time, heat and air pollution are causing alerts and breaking records in Germany, France, and Belgium, as well as China, Australia, and Singapore. They foretell a brutal summer assault, and I'm reminded of the words of both Guy McPherson and Paul Beckwith. The immediate future is not going to be anything like the recent past. Paris has suffered a spring smog attack. One of my French friends today posted that all public transportation in Paris is free. Driving is now banned on alternate days, like, you know, for the end of your license number. And that's Paris. But if you've been to Paris and you try to consider that, that's something pretty amazing. Singapore is succumbing to drought. They've had no rain in almost 3 months. This is their rainy season. The jungle is turning brown. Singapore is known as one of the wettest places on earth, and it's struggling seriously. With respect and with regard to nuclear stuff, there's been a lot of news this week, and we're going to talk about that with Libby. But just before we went to press tonight, the ENE News posted that the Fairbanks, Alaska City Council unanimously passed a Fukushima monitoring resolution. I guess that was Friday, but it just broke the news today. It was dated March 10th, excuse me. Okay, so but that's recent. We just found out about it today. Only about 3 years too late, but, you know, better than nothing. And Mimi Gurman, who's been a guest on the show twice from Radcast, made some observations about the numbers of scrams and incidents that are taking place all over the country. And then Arne Gundersen, he was interviewed with Amy Goodman. Amy asked the right question, and how does climate change fit in with both nuclear and the nuclear issues. And Gunderson said climate change has affected nuclear plants this year. And basically the problem is droughts are leading to a lack of water. You can't portray nuclear power as a way to eliminate climate change. We need to solve climate change before we can have nuclear power plants. That's a quote from Arne Gunderson. So we are seeing all kinds of impacts on that, and this is a perfect day to have a show because on the 11th, the anniversary, I listened to Libby Halevi's broadcast at nuclearhotseat.com, and she's just such an accomplished professional journalist, broadcaster, writer, editor. I don't know if she runs a one-woman shop. We'll find out. But she does just a sterling job of presentation, timing, organization, writing, and everything else. And she gave a broadcast on the third anniversary that was truly a heartbreaker, and it was exceptionally well done. Her website, nuclearhotseat.com, gets about 500,000 downloads a week all over the world. And Carolyn Baker posted on Facebook after hearing Libby's broadcast this week that she wrote, "Thank you, Mike, for posting this amazing podcast. I thank Libby Halevi for what she accomplished in bringing us this stunning broadcast." She invited everyone to listen. So Libby Halevi is a survivor from 1 mile away of Three Mile Island, 1985. Nuclear podcast has been running since about 3 months after Fukushima. And she covers all aspects of the nuclear issue in an extremely professional way. I mean, she's just so skilled. She has also just published an ebook, "Yes, I Glow in the Dark: 1 Mile from 3 Mile Island to Fukushima and Beyond," and it's doing well. It was Amazon. It was number one in its category in Kindle for 3 days in a row. Overall sales ranked just over 10,000, which doesn't sound like much, but that's out of over 1 million titles. So you do the percentages. It's doing very well. And I know it's well written. She's someone, and I'm actually going to let her talk here in a second. She is someone who, along with Arne Gunderson, Helen Caldicott, Mimi Gurman, Chris Busby, and yes, I will include Hattrick Penry because he's been vindicated recently in the last week, 10 days on NRC documents. She is one of a group of people who are doing what governments and the media will not, giving us reliable, usable information that from which we can construct a picture, even though it may not be pretty, of what's going on with nuclear in the world. Libby, welcome to the Lifeboat Hour. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Michael. It's lovely to be here with you and have the chance to speak directly to your people.
Great. You know, we have a pretty sophisticated audience here. We are big picture people. We have addressed the deepest, darkest aspects not only of nuclear but of climate change, infinite growth, peak oil, and so on and so forth. But you have a very particular expertise. So I've got a question I want to start with, because you've been on this field since Three Mile Island, which I think was 79, right?
Yes, it was.
And okay, so since Fukushima, has attention to issues of safety, remediation, retrofitting, has that picture improved at all since Fukushima?
Before I answer that, I think I need to roll this back slightly in the conversation.
Sure.
Because, yes, I was 1 mile away from Three Mile Island when it happened, and I fell for the lies for the first 2 days and a smidge until that announcement went down the middle of the street saying, "Stay indoors and do not go outside unless you absolutely have to, and close your windows and stay away from them."
Mm-hmm.
So I went through that trauma in the aftermath, which is what I cover in the book, but what you need to understand is that I was so traumatized by the experience, it was post-traumatic stress, that other than a brief attempt to be an anti-nuclear activist in the wake of that, when I just couldn't handle it, I was just being re-triggered too much, mm-hmm. I stayed completely away from the nuclear accident until Fukushima happened.
Okay.
The activism that you see for me has only happened since that time.
Okay, thank you.
From the perspective that I have gained, and, you know, watching this up close and personal, you know, down to the nubbins every day for 3 years now, I look for patterns. It's about pattern recognition and what's going on. First of all, Three Mile Island was remarkable because there was no defense against it. So the media of the world got there, responded, landed on the ground. Reporters were exposed to radiation like everyone else. And on the fifth anniversary, I believe it was, there was a reporter who wrote about the fact that he had come down with cancer a few years before then, and he directly attributed it to having been at Three Mile Island. Mm-hmm. So there was an incredible openness about the dialogue, about the fear, about the problems. What the nuclear industry got from that is that they cannot in any way let any negative information out when an accident happens, which is why today, after they've spent 35 years, because we're coming up on March 28th on the 35th anniversary of Three Mile Island,
right,
they have spent 35 years developing a highly funded infrastructure of liars, people bought off, politicians paid, people put into positions where educational materials could be manipulated. I mean, it's legion the ways that they have done their propaganda, so that as Fukushima showed us, there's no honest information coming out. There's no regular media coverage. Everybody's been taken out of that game. So if you're asking me whether there's been more awareness, perhaps in those of us who either have been following this issue or were recruited to it by Fukushima, as right. I was. I refer to Three Mile Island as the mule kick that knocked me out of the life I was living, and Fukushima as the mule kick that got me back into it. Other than those of us who are us, there's only a vague discomfort at best in the outside world in terms of people's awareness. And in terms of the industry itself, it's hard to tell. I think that they are much more on the alert for how they have to manipulate us away from panic, meaning away from truthful information, than there is about attention to safety.
Okay. Let me ask this, which was a great answer. Thank you, because you paint well on a large canvas. We know, for example, that the reactors at Fukushima Daiichi were GE Mark I's and that they're fatally flawed in terms of design. Since Fukushima, has there been any indication that anybody is trying to retrofit or put any more money to make all of the Mark I reactors in existence of that, and that would include Indian Point near New York City, any safer?
There may have been some superficial things done. And again, this is my take, and I will clearly state right now, I am not an expert on the tech, on the engineering. Virtually everything I know is what I've picked up from people like Arnie Gunderson and Ace Hoffman here in Southern California, who is an ace on this issue, and other people in other writings that I have gotten.
Okay.
But to the best of my knowledge, there's no culpability that has gone back to GE for having designed the Mark I, or GE Hitachi as it is now. And I think that any changes that have taken place are superficial and don't go to the core issues, the safety of the steam generators that are wearing out, the age of the nuclear reactors. I saw somebody post, it may have been on one of your threads, about with all of the accidents in storage that have seemed to have been happening in the last week, do we think it's a conspiracy? And I posted immediately, and I said, no, it's not a conspiracy. It's just most of these reactors are the same vintage. So the parts are wearing out at about the same time, which is why suddenly we are seeing an escalating number and severity of accidents, and we're not going to roll back from that. It's just going to keep getting worse.
Okay. One of the things that you do, and you do so well, and I have to say again how much respect I have for the way you put your broadcast together. You do a great job. You track the news. You track events. You are a vampire for information about nuclear. and it has been a really busy week. What comes to the top of your head this week, aside from the British Navy shooting a fake torpedo at a nuclear dump? What else comes to your head this week of significance?
Well, that's the preview of the numbnuts of the week, because I don't think they could be more boneheaded than that.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. In producing the special that I did this week, the Fukushima Anniversary Special Voices from Japan, as you can imagine, that was an extremely elaborate production.
Yes.
I could not have done without the assistance of my co-producer, Beverly Finlay Kaneko, on it. But because of my involvement with that and posting it in both English and Japanese, that took the bulk of my attention up to the night of the 11th.
Okay.
And then in the middle of the night between the 11th and the 12th, I turned, my computer was next to my bed, I rolled over in bed, I knocked something over, I spilled liquid on my computer. So I've spent the week since then trying to get back on track with a new computer. We're not going to talk about what that did. So I haven't been as spot on as I usually am about this, but what sticks with me on the one hand is the fact that people are protesting all over the place, and the resistances to receiving this information and passing it on is not just in the media. It's in the coordinated protest that was done at Japanese consulates around the world, where the majority of them refused to take the information, even though they must under Japanese constitution. That the stories that aired that I did catch on mainstream media were just not focused, or they were focused on side issues like the workers' rights at Fukushima, as opposed to the macro of what this is doing to people, to the planet, to health, the impact. None of that was covered. It was all, oh, it's that problem over there, and it's the workers who are being exposed, and so it doesn't have a chance to bleed out into general consciousness and general awareness.
Okay.
So really, what was being done, what I caught from it, and again, this is looking at the patterning, pattern recognition, is that the media was sidetracked into, well, we've got to say something, let's not make it dangerous, let's not make people uncomfortable about it, and let's say we've done our duty and then move on.
Okay, so that's an interesting place to break, and we're right at the point where here at the nightclub at the end of the world, I like to mix music with the hard stuff. It's a way of entering the heart with the mind. And you sent a song, and I'm going to let you tell us about it. It's a song called Ma Nature, which is all queued up and ready to play. And I understand you wrote the lyrics for it, but you've had some experience as being involved with Broadway or show productions. You're a lyricist. Tell us about the song, and then we're going to hear it.
The long, sad story of my involvement in musical theater, you can read about in Yes, I Glow in the Dark. I don't want to get into details, but this is from a show that actually came out of my Three Mile Island experience. It was never produced for reasons I don't need to get into here.
Sure.
But what you're going to hear is a demo. The show was called Armageddon. It was a positive look at the end of the world. And it was done as a satire, and at the same time, there was some very serious information that was included in it. But all of it made as lighthearted, jovial, funny, and sarcastic as I possibly could.
And
so in this particular scene, our lead character has just run into a Mother Nature who looks much like the one from the old chiffon margarine commercials, if you're old enough to remember those. And except she's like all smudged up and she's tattered and she's like staggering around. And after a little bit of dialogue, this is the song that Ma Nature sings. Demo piano vocal, but you'll get the sense of it.
What year was it recorded?
Oh, I wrote this 30 years ago.
This
just shortly after Three Mile Island happened.
You are prescient. Here is Ma Nature, lyrics by Libby Halevy.
Stop, look around you, think, touch, smell, life is all around you. Got it well, reconsider what I'm worth. If you plan to stay on Earth, I'm Mother Nature. Don't mess with me. We need all this planet. Land, sea, air, take it from your mommy. You'd better care, think it through and have no doubt. See how time is running out. I'm on nature, don't mess with me. There's no denying that slowly I'm dying.
Incredible. Look what you're doing. It's mother you're screwing. How Oedipal. Stop, look around you. Hear my voice. Keep it up and one day I'll have no choice. If your careless ways don't halt, it won't be San Andreas's fault. Stop and look around you. Think, touch, smell. Everywhere a warning. Can't you tell? You don't have a way to leave. I will give you no reprieve. I'm my nature. Don't mess with me.
That was 30 years ago. I'm going to call you a prophet, Libby.
Well,
I'm going to rank you right up there with
my time in one way or another.
I'm going to rank you right up there with Terrence McKenna. You got the picture. Most of us on because we have talked so much about nuclear on this show, we are aware of other dangerous nuclear locations like Hanford, like Indian Point, like WIP in New Mexico, if you have anything new on that, which seems to be serious. What are other geographic or other areas of concern, either here in the U.S. or around the world, that you're keeping an eye on? What perks your antenna when you hear the name dropped?
Oh, well, I think anything. I'm getting an echo, by the way.
Yeah, I hear that, too. I have no control. The board will check on that. Okay.
Okay. What really grabs my attention is whatever is coming up and how it relates to what I already know. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's the Tennessee Valley site where Sister Megan Rice was arrested for peaceful protest and given another 3 years in prison. Now, they don't do anything to guys from Wall Street. They give a nun 3 years in prison for praying at a nuclear facility. I'm very concerned about the WIP site in Hanford right now because they are linked in many ways. By the way, is this sound coming across okay?
I'm getting a note from the board. I don't know if you're on a cell or a landline, but the board is asking me to ask you to call back.
Okay, I will do that right now.
Okay, she's going to do that, and we'll pick up that thought as soon as we get Libby Halevi back on the line. She does every week, it comes out Tuesday, I believe, Monday or Tuesday, a weekly podcast, which is extremely well done, in which she summarizes and digests all of the news that is nuclear around the world. And in doing that, she provides us with a great many data points to see where things are creaking and groaning, where things are dangerous, and as in the case with WIP, the Waste Something pilot project in Carlsbad, New Mexico, which stores americium and plutonium from the nuclear weapons program. I understand we have Libby back. Libby, are you back?
Yes, I am, and I think it's going to be better.
Okay, good.
Echo again. I'm going to call you back. Seven.
Oops, now you're starting to cut out again. Yeah, we're hearing the echo. Okay, so we're going to try to get her back in a second as she calls back from a landline. Anyway, I don't miss the broadcast because if there's anything that's urgent developing around nuclear, I find out either from her or, of course, Amy Gurman from Radcast, who performs a slightly different function by tracking the releases. And there's so many avenues to pursue, and that's why we need so many great eyes on the field to share with us. Her book, Yes, I Glow in the Dark, is available on Amazon Kindle. Again, it was number one in its category 3 days in a row. Its sales were ranked right up there, and I put a little blurb up about it on my Facebook page. And it sounds like kind of what we got from listening to Libby's music, the art from her heart, as well as what she does from, if you will, the left brain side. We get a sense of who she is, and she brings that integrity, I believe, to what she I don't believe. She brings that integrity and authenticity to her work. Now, let's see if we have her back. Libby, are you back?
I'm back, and this time I'm on a landline.
Oh, you sound marvelous. Thank you.
Thank you, darling. Thank you.
Where were we?
I don't know. You got to remind me.
God, it's not Alzheimer's, it's sometimers, but I'm sure I'm okay, let me.
Oh, you were asking me about where I was putting my attention?
Yes.
And this is where the pattern recognition kicks in for me, because there are a number of interconnected pieces. First of all, I've been covering WIP very closely. I have a source who's with a watchdog group down in New Mexico, a man named Don Hancock, who's been very valuable to the program. And all things being equal, I will have another update from him on the show this Tuesday, because there has been a lot that's been happening here.
Yes.
But part of the situation that WIP has created is that, with it being the only licensed, certified, whatever it is, waste repository in the country, with it being out of commission right now until they figure out what happened and how they can fix it, no waste can be shipped there. That is impacting the Savannah River site.
Ah.
That is impacting, I can't name all of them. I don't have all the names in front of them, but it's impacting Hanford as well. Now, the things about Hanford that are very upsetting right now are, first of all, it's leaking. We've known that for a while. Secondly, a dam only 40 miles upstream from Hanford has been found to have a 2-inch crack in it going 65 feet across in one of the side causeways. That may not be the exact terminology, but that's what it is. You know the old saying, run for the hills, the dam's busting?
Yeah.
If that goes, that's one of the, like, terrorist risks that was mentioned in a report from the NRC that I think was placed out sometime last year, that upstream from many nuclear reactors that are inland, there are dams that, if they were compromised, could send a cascade of water down and possibly create an inland equivalent of Fukushima. So we've got Hanford already leaking. We've got a compromised dam with a 65-foot, 2-inch crack going almost entirely across it with the possibility of failure. Just downstream from there, thanks to Mimi Gurman, I learned that the Columbia Generating Station is located. So if a surge of water comes down and cannot be controlled by the one dam that stands between Hanford and this one, there's going to be a surge of water with the potential of washing in and over the site and thus transporting the open pit radionuclides that are stored there into the Columbia River, into the watershed, and then further downstream, and God only knows what the water can do at the Columbia Generating Station.
Okay, which begs an extremely important question that I have talked about almost since Fukushima occurred, that my dear friend Guy McPherson and colleague Carolyn Baker, we are all concerned about this. There are some 450 commercial nuclear reactors in the world. I don't know how many nuclear storage facilities there are, but that's not counting the military and the research and university reactors. What's your honest assessment of let's say we had the will now, of the ability of the human race to shut them all down safely and put them in dry cast storage before they melt?
Well, from my understanding of dry cask storage, it is a bit of kicking them down the road, the problem down the road for another generation or two, because they are concrete casks. Again, I don't know the full science of it, but that they are not secure forever. None of this is forever, and we're dealing with plutonium, which has a half-life of 24,000 years, let alone that it's going to take, that's only how long it takes for it to become half as toxic. It takes 20 half-life cycles for it to go flat, meaning 480,000 years. I don't know that we can imagine what would actually contain the waste for that long until it is neutralized.
Uh-huh.
If we shut down everything tomorrow, and that would be a happy day on the one hand, but then it's a matter of what do we do with the nuclear garbage?
Right.
And there are lots of theories out there. I know I did a program on the Roy process, but in talking with Arjun Makajani, doing a process like that, which was about knocking neutrons off of plutonium to cut the half-life down to almost nothing, would create a whole pile of other nuclear waste that would be as dangerous, if not more dangerous, in the short term. The short term being, you know, 300 years, 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not feasible. One thing that I discovered, and I have not seen discussed, perhaps you have and I missed it, is that there's a book called First Contact by Mark Kaufman. It came out about 3 years ago, and it was about signs of science. This was a very scientific book, but signs of how there may have been extraterrestrial life seeded in various forms on Earth. And one of the things he pointed to was some microorganism of some sort that has been found only in a 2,000-foot deep mine, I think it was a salt mine, in South Africa, that doesn't have any contact with sunlight. I mean, it is pitch black down there. But there is radiation on the walls, and that's what this organism eats.
Was there not also some kind of bacteria found at Chernobyl of a similar nature?
I'm not familiar with that. If so, I would love to learn about it. Because if, and I recently ran into somebody I'm still pursuing for a longer conversation who said that these kind of organisms could be, what is it, geoengineered or nanoengineered, you know, when they work down on that microscopic level,
right,
to engineer a microbe of some sort. Why is that not being pursued? Because that, first of all, that would make somebody's fortune. And would also have the potential to save us from this horrible situation that we have gotten ourselves into.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's take it from the standpoint of all of a sudden you're God.
No, I had that delusion. I got over it. Thank you.
No,
but okay. Well, for the sake of argument.
All right, and you know, because this was a question that haunted me for so many years, as people asked me about peak oil and collapse and exponential growth, and they say, well, what do we do? And the meanest people would ask me, okay, you're king of the world, what would you do to address it tomorrow? And I found myself pretty short of practicable, implementable answers. But let's say you were God and you had the absolute power to say what happens with nuclear, what would you do?
Well, if I was not able to just, you know, wave my magic wand over everything and say, poof, you're now neutral and there's no problem, it would be the program that I proposed 6 months after Fukushima when I was a speaker at TEDx Pasadena.
Oh, tell us.
It's 4 points. First of all, shut them down immediately. Immediately. Secondly, take all the money that is in federal loan guarantees and underwriting and all the rest, take it away from nuclear and pour it immediately into solar. Not top-down solar like, what was it, Solyndra?
Right.
But to all the little mom-and-pop places that have been growing up locally, because there's much more solar energy being generated in this country than is showing up in the records, because, as I have learned, anything that is generated on a rooftop that's used by a house doesn't feed back into the system, doesn't feed back into the grid, so it's not metered. None of that is used as locally generated, meaning immediately generated from rooftop, is measured. So we've got a lot more solar going on. So the second piece of it would be to take all that money and give incentives, underwrite it, put solar on every rooftop in America, in every backyard in America, in the middle of the desert where you can't have solar, have wind, have them both, do geothermal, all of the different methodologies that are out there. And we need top-down leadership on this. It's not going to happen by us struggling uphill trying to push this thing. It's going to take really strong political will. Leading up to World War II with FDR's leadership, we accomplished miracles in this country because we had a leader who said, we're going to do this, we're not going to do this, we're all going to have to bite the bullet, but we're doing it for this larger reason. We need somebody who's going to frame it that way and take it forward. The third piece is that we have to look for ways to neutralize the neutralize the radiation that we've already created with the tons. And when I first joined this movement 3 years ago in an active way, we were talking about 70 tons of high-level nuclear waste. That was 3 years ago. We've generated more, and we haven't changed our statistic on it. So that needs to be up-leveled, but we need to find some way to neutralize and store until neutralization is possible the waste that is there. And, oh gosh, I'm forgetting the fourth piece of it right now.
Oh,
but it was good. It was good. I'll post it on the website.
Okay. All right. So you, and that was actually comforting to me. It actually made a little sense. Assuming someone with absolute dictatorial powers who was not a corporate stooge and owned by the banks or the nuclear industry was there, who had and was willing to exercise the power, that's a good step. Shut everything down immediately and remove every financial incentive for nuclear and transfer it all immediately to alternative energy sources to be implemented. Yes, okay.
I just remembered the last piece.
Go ahead.
Again, leadership top down. Conservation, conservation, conservation. I'm sorry, but we really don't need our Christmas lights. I know we have a sentimental attachment, but that's just a minor thing that we can get rid of. We need to look at all in essential energy use, and for the sake of our planet and our children's and our great-grandchildren's great-grandchildren's future, we need to cut back on our usage, because that alone will lessen how much energy has to be produced. It will put us more in alignment with what can be generated already through renewable, sustainable methodologies, and give us some breathing space. But again, without top-down leadership on this to say to the country, you know, we have a problem, this is the problem, don't panic, this is what you can do. As long as there is action possible, people will have some place to put the energy that comes from emotional upset and actually feel that they are doing something that is making a difference.
Yes.
And that will make the difference in our level of involvement of people in this country as well,
that,
I believe.
That is so important to psychologically, spiritually, energetically enable people allowing them to do something other than flail and feel helpless. That's
mm-hmm.
critically important. But I came back to one point that I've made pretty much my whole career, which is that until we change the infinite growth paradigm, the mandate for growth at all costs, more gadgets, more things, more money, more this, more that, more human beings, we are still trapped in a horrible paradox. So it would take a real fundamental shift in consciousness for something like this to happen. We aren't going to do it by circulating a petition. Maybe when we're all glowing in the dark, which is a good entree for the second song here. Maybe when we're all glowing in the dark and a ham and eggs breakfast, the chicken's involved, but the pig is committed. And what you are doing and so many other people are doing is let us understand that we are all, if you will, pigs in this equation, in that all of our lives are truly on the line. I'm going to play the second song, and then after that, if it's okay with you, Bibi, we will take some calls. But I get now to play a joke and to rectify something that I wanted to rectify for a long time on this show. Throughout the 3.5 years I've done this show, I've never played a song by my good friend Michael Yost, who played with us on New White Trash. He's one of the world's best guitarists. He is a superstar. You can find him at Michael Yost, J-O-S-T. If you Google him, but he's on ReverbNation.com/Michael Yost. And I never played any of his songs because I didn't have any immediate links. That's been rectified to his tunes. And he's a dear friend, and I miss him a lot. But he wrote a great song, which I have seen him perform many times, and he will be performing this song, I believe, at the Venice Beach Music Festival on May 31st. He'll be one of the headliners there down in Venice, California. But here is a song called Nuclear Spinach, I Couldn't Resist.
In Venice up in. If you don't fit in anywhere else, you'll end up in Venice. Thank you.
That was Michael Yost, J-O-S-T, Nuclear Spinach. I love the way he plays, and that was a little brief interlude there. If you'd like to call in and ask Bibi Halevi a question, please, the number is 1-888-874-4888, 1-888-874-4888. And now that we have you back on the show, we're down to about the last 10, 15 minutes or so. Bibi, what is on your agenda, on your plate? Are you in a place where you're just going to, are you expanding? Because you get a lot of attention. Where are you going?
You know, God only knows on this one, but I just show up every day and see what's there. But I do have a few things that are coming up.
Sure.
First of all, the book is selling very well, and I continue to move that forward. At the point when I have accrued the right amount of money, I will be able to then publish it as a physical book, which is one of my plans. Mm-hmm. I will continue to do Nuclear Hot Seat every week because I can't not do it.
Uh-huh. I understand that.
What I have coming up in 2 weeks, meaning a week from this Tuesday, is my 3 Mile Island anniversary special, which this will be the third year I've done it, and this year I have two additional interviews that are going to be incorporated in it, because it's my personal narration, but I weave in Arnie Gunderson, I weave in things that I've learned since that time, and all kinds of bits and pieces. And this year I add an interview with Peter Bradford, who is an NRC commissioner at that time and features prominently in the events at 3 Mile Island and is featured prominently in the book The Warning by Mike Gray and Ira Rosen. And if people haven't read that book, they really need to see what was different about media coverage back then, but also to understand the nature of human error when it comes to a nuclear accident and how deadly that can be.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that special. I have a Chernobyl special, which will be coming up the week of April 26th. I think my post date on that is the 22nd. And between now and then, the first week in April, I'm going to be in Washington State. And I will be speaking April 2nd in Yelm, Y-E-L-M. There's a very big gathering that's going to be happening there, and it's going to be not just me coming from the front and speaking, but it will also include the chance for people to network and start really building the movement. And while I am in Washington State, I'm looking for other speaking engagements, other media opportunities, activists I can get together with so we can do some brainstorming and see how to network with each other. One of the side benefits of me having produced the podcast now for almost 3 years, in June it will be 3 years, is that it has put me in touch with an extraordinary set of activists literally around the world.
Mm.
And because of that, if somebody's got an issue in one place, I can usually say, you know, there's this person over in this other place I think you would do well to speak with because there's a parallel in what you are discussing. And in that way, start building our network with each other so that we can start stepping forward as a unified national, local, national, and international movement, as opposed to being good-natured, energetic activists in a small area who don't quite know how to fit in with a larger picture or doing what seems right locally, but they don't have to reinvent the wheel. The wheel's already been invented. They just have to find somebody who can teach it to them.
That begs a wonderful question that you are perhaps in a unique position to answer. What is the state of the anti-nuclear movement and or anti-nuclear consciousness on the planet today? Organized, disorganized, coalescing, leadership, give us an overview, because you're probably better equipped to do that than anybody I can think of.
The biggest thing we have to do if we want to up-level and really move into a position of influence, power, and getting this thing turned around, we must work on our communication skills,
mm-hmm.
on our sales skills, and on our marketing skills. Our movement, in all of its many ramifications, does not lack for information. We are lousy with information.
Yes.
We can cite chapter and verse and blah-de-de-blah.
Yes.
And most people can understand a three-word slogan from Fox News and not much beyond. When we start, as it's said in the sales world, vomiting our information on people, the eyes glaze over, the brain shuts down, and they can't hear it.
Mm-hmm.
We need to work in a concerted way to simplify our message, to make it consistent across the board. One of the points I think is one of the strongest that we can use to really tap into where people are living is to explain to them not only that radiation equals cancer, but why radiation is dangerous, what it is and what it does. Those of us who are old enough to have lived through the Cold War in the 1950s and the anti-Russia propaganda about nuclear were very deeply instilled with understanding of radiation and that it was dangerous and what it did. But in the time since then, that message has gone away. And there are people who think of radiation as, oh, that's what you get, that's the treatment you get if you've got cancer. Hmm. Or that's the X-ray that you get that helps in diagnosis. What's so wrong with radiation? And they don't understand that the radiologist has to stand behind a lead shield in order to give the treatment, even though it's supposed to be not harmful to you. And it is harmful, but it's a tiny dose, but it adds up over time. People don't understand it. So we need to explain this in sound bites, in small, manageable pieces of information, and figure out our talking points, and then do what Fox News does. It's like, I hate what they do, but I have to admire the way in which they do it because they're brilliant at getting an evil message across. We have to boil our talking points down and then agree that this week, this month, this is what we're all going to be addressing from all the different directions. So a consistent message goes out across all platforms, be it from NIRS, be it from Beyond Nuclear. Arnie's doing his thing. Helen's, Dr. Caldicott is doing her thing. I'm doing my thing. You doing your thing. All the different programs that are out there.
Right.
We all focus on radiation, what the danger is, how it operates, what it does to the human body, why it is so dangerous in the long run, and why we must protect ourselves against that. It's my belief that without a deep understanding of that key piece of the equation, we're just shouting in the wind. Because people don't understand what the danger is to them. And if we link radiation with cancer, according to National Institute of Health statistics, 41% of us are expected to get cancer in our lifetimes. Before Trinity, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, cancer was a rare disease.
Yes.
But it has been spiking, and specifically since the late 1990s, and Dr. Caldicott has written that the first cancers that hit are of the thyroid and leukemia, and that's in the first 2 to 5 years afterwards. Hard tumors usually take, unless you've had a catastrophic dose, hard tumors take 12 to 15 years to show up. The cancer statistics in the United States started spiking 1998-99 and haven't gone in the other direction since. 98-99, you're starting to look at the 12 to 15-year window after Chernobyl.
So there is, and these are, that's an excellent piece of information that you could almost bumper stickerize, showing the connection between Chernobyl then and cancer showing up now. Of course, we have also found no shortage of ingenious ways to poison ourselves with chemical toxicity and all kinds of other toxins and pollutants, which is affecting the cancer rate, but we know that radiation is deadly, and there is no such thing as a safe dose of radiation for anybody. Not man-made radiation. That's for sure. It sounds and it feels a bit Sisyphean. We do the right thing because it is the right thing. What has been? We've got like a couple of minutes left. What has been the most rewarding experiences or take that you have had in the 3 years of doing your broadcast? What keeps you coming back?
What keeps me coming back is if I did not do this show, I think that by centrifugal force I would fly off the face of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
I really think that the only thing that keeps me grounded in the middle of this is that I take in the information, but I can put it out immediately. in a form that hopefully communicates to the greatest number of people. In terms of the greatest single piece of gratification I've gotten, I have to say it's been this last week and the response to the program that I did, Voices from Japan.
Wonderful. That was such a good show.
Do you know it's up in Japanese as well as English?
Yes.
Here's the other piece that I only found out about this morning. Yesterday in Japan, in Tokyo, they had the Sayonara Nukes rally. And the very famous actress who was hosting it, she was emceeing it, Midori Kyuchi, at one point in, you can watch the video, it's all in Japanese, but at one point, she was one of the people on the Voices from Japan. She started talking about Nuclear Hot Seat and me and the program and Three Mile Island to all the assembled people there. I am so humbled that the Japanese people trusted me with this, that they are opening themselves up, and we've had such overwhelming response. We now have another 6 to 8 interviews in the can that we weren't able to use. This is now going to be a continuing feature. A Nuclear Hot Seat, where it's going to be people from Japan, direct address, what the truth is as they see it.
We bear witness. Libby Halevi, you are so valuable, and I want you to know that you're totally appreciated by us. I hope that this show gives you a little boost. It's very important to give energy to the people who are serving and giving us what we need back, and you are deeply appreciated. Libby, from nuclearhotseat.com, you got your new got a new podcast going up this week. You're busy as a bee, and you are a trooper in the trenches, and I just want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much, and I want to remind people, if they go to Amazon and they put in either my name or Yes, I Glow in the Dark, they'll see my ebook, and it's not just my personal story, but it's how the nuclear industry tricked us and what we can do about it.
I love it. Your experience is so useful to us. You are an elder, you are a teacher, and we're glad you're here. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael. It was lovely to be with you today.
Thank you. Before I sign off tonight, just a couple of notes. We have a change in the programs for next week. Cale Sampson, the hip-hop artist, an awesome guy, wrote a song that just blew me away. He's going to be my guest next week. We're going to play one song and spend almost the whole show talking about that. I had to switch him with Rich Heinberg. Rich Heinberg of Post Carbon, my old friend, who will join us on March 30th. And I'll keep you updated on my adventures. This is Michael C. Rupert, Tracker of Truth, here on the Lifeboat Hour. I love you guys. We'll see you next week. Good night.
I don't know.